This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Frederick L. Brown. Fred holds a PhD in history from the University of Washington and works on a contract basis as a historian for the National Park Service. Fred Brown is here to tell us about his book, The City is More Than Human, An Animal History of Seattle, published in 2016. Welcome, Fred.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Why did you choose to examine the history of animals in Seattle? Why is understanding the history of animals in Seattle important?
Well, I think animals are so much a part of our life, and they are integrated into our lives in so many ways, but yet in a lot of ways they're invisible. So they've certainly been invisible in the history of the city. So I became interested in this when I was in graduate school and studying U.S. history. And I think for a number of reasons, animals, there are a number of paradoxes and complexities in the way we deal with animals that bear looking at.
What do you mean by the phrase, the city is more than human?
Well, I think we often think of the history of cities as a human history, as the history of people building things, people having plans, people having politics, people having economics, and that animals are a sideline and not a particularly important part of that. But I tried to look at how does history look if we take the role of animals seriously, if we look at how animals have been part of debates over property, debates over place, debates over identity, and they're really woven into history in so many ways. So history is not only what humans do. History is not humans making plans and implementing them. History is humans with all other creatures creating a world together.
In your book, you speak about both sorting and blending of animals. Would you explain?
Yeah, well, a big theme of the book is that the categories we use in thinking about people and the categories we use in thinking about animals intertwine in the city, and that those categories bear looking at. And if we think about those categories, we think about categories in thinking about people along lines of race, class, and gender, or the categories we use in thinking about animals, categories like human versus animal, domestic versus wild, pet versus livestock. There's sorting and blending. Those categories are important. Those categories shape experiences, and yet they don't determine experiences. There's lots of overlap. The difference between domestic and wild is important, yet those overlap. The difference between pets and livestock is important, yet there are many creatures that blend together those roles. So there's sorting and there's blending.
Would you say more about the implications of sorting animals?
Well, I think it's been part of struggles over place and over power throughout Seattle's history. I think the sorting of animals has been woven into the very laws that we use in thinking about what the city is. The sorting of animals appears in the land laws that newcomers used in the 1850s to make claims to land. There was an actual sense in which race and land ownership and animal ownership came together in the fact that the Oregon Donation Act of 1850 said that white people could own land if it was cultivated. And cultivation implied this European style of agriculture, which implied domestic animals. So that's one example of the many ways that sorting animals, that making rules about which animals belong where, were an important part of shaping the city.
How did the Native Americans in the Puget Sound area and the European settlers view animals differently?
So there are very different sets of ideas about how animals fit into the world. If you look, for instance, at stories that Salish people had of the myth time and compare that with the Bible, which has stories that were important to white newcomers, you see very different roles of animals. You see that Salish people envision animals as spiritual allies and as creatures that had agency, and that it was important that there be ritual respect for salmon so that they would return. There was the importance of treating deer properly so that they could be hunted, whereas Europeans saw more of a hierarchy. And the stories that Salish people told often had animals as people, whereas the Bible, for instance, very rarely do animals speak. So a very different set of ideas about animals came into conflict when newcomers arrived here in the 1830s and the 1850s.
Well, you alluded to this a bit earlier, but in what ways did sorting animals into wild and domestic help define Seattle as a Euro-American space?
Newcomers came here, and it was very important to create this space where their domestic animals could thrive, and that involved these material conflicts with the wild animals, especially the larger wild animals that had been here before, and that involved killing cougars and killing wolves. And it was, you know, materially important to establish the type of agriculture and the type of city that they envisioned that they kill these animals. And in some cases, it almost became symbolically important, killing cougars. I look at the stories that white settlers told, and there's almost a celebration of killing those cougars, as if this is a sign that this place is a very different place and this place will become a European-American place.
What was the role of livestock in acquiring native land?
There was a set of conflicts emerged when Seattle was founded in the 1850s, but earlier in the 1830s when Fort Nisqually was founded. And Fort Nisqually was a fur trading post that the Hudson Bay Company had established. It's about 60 miles south of where we are here in Seattle. The site is near the Nisqually River. And not only was that a fur trading post, it was also an agricultural station. And they brought cattle and sheep there. And those cattle wandered far from the fort. And they were, in a certain sense, the most visible sign of this European presence in native space. And that created conflicts. And there was a conflict in part over what is domestic and what is wild, that newcomers thought of these as domestic animals that could be owned as property, and yet they were ranging far from the fort, and they were actually becoming wild, and native people hunted them as wild animals. And this provided an excuse for newcomers to impose their vision of ownership by punishing the Nisqually people who were hunting these animals who were on their land. So that's just one example of the many ways that newcomers bringing their animals created conflict and were the first very material evidence of a claim of land ownership that eventually resulted in treaties and in the dispossession of native peoples of most of their land.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Frederick L. Brown, author of the book, The City is More Than Human, An Animal History of Seattle. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What role did cows play in Seattle's early history?
Cows were really special in Seattle. Cows had a status that almost no other large animal had, because milk was incredibly important to people's identity, to the white newcomers and other newcomers who arrived here in the 1850s. You see the importance of milk in the fact that in 1851, before there are any cows, the stories of the little baby Roland Denny having to resort to clam juice rather than milk, that was so important that those stories were told, you know, 50 and 100 years later. So milk was seen as an essential part of the European diet, and that was something that native people had never used. And cows had special access to public place. There is what one could call a cow commons.
Say more about the cows that wandered around Seattle in the early days.
Yeah, well, if I might, I could read a passage from the book that talks about the importance of cows in public spaces and how one woman used the cow commons. Sarah Ewing relied on cows to survive in the city in the 1890s. Living near downtown Seattle, she had negotiated with many nearby property owners so her cows could graze their vacant lots. She and her children herded her stock from their barn and through city streets to make use of these scattered pastures. Those cows and those grassy lots allowed her, Ewing said, quote, part of the means of gaining a livelihood. It was Ewing and her children who cared for the cows, finding them graze, milking them, and selling the milk. On January 18, 1892, however, her cows fell afoul of an alternate vision of urban life. That morning, the poundmaster, Albert E. Boyd, and his dog took three of her cows and drove them into the city's cattle pound. Ewing claimed that two of the cows were grazing a vacant lot, with the owner's permission, and that Ewing's daughter was herding the third. Boyd claimed the cows were running at large within the pound limits, violating a city ordinance. Ewing was using the commons for cattle, as newcomers had done since they took that land from Duwamish and other Salish peoples. As the city grew more dense and populous, and as the middle class sought to define their neighborhoods and their city as modern and urban, many saw no place for cows. The rules Boyd was enforcing would become ever more restrictive until herding cows in the commons was finally banned in 1907.
How have horses helped shape the city of Seattle?
And horses are crucially important as well, and I think it's important to keep in mind that we think of horses as an old economy and a sign of backwardness, and yet horses help make the city modern. Horses did work in construction, horses pulled carriages, and the very shape of the city, in a certain sense, was defined by horses in that it had very wide streets, wide enough for horse-drawn conveyances. Before the arrival of white settlers, transportation in this place was with canoes and along trails, but the shape of the city was really defined by horses, and the work they did helped create the modern city.
Would you tell us about the 4th of July workhorse parade that took place in the early days?
And so horses were celebrated by the Humane Society and by other people in Seattle for their crucial role in the city. And there were a number of horse parades where all of the workhorses of the city, from butchers to shops to grocery stores to all the city departments that use horses, were paraded downtown. And the goal was to show the importance of horses and to show the importance of being kind to horses. So horses had a crucial role in the city, and that was celebrated in these workhorse parades.
Why were horses allowed in the city when cows were banned?
It's a very different relationship with cows and horses. For one thing, the owner of cows were not the wealthiest people in the city, and therefore I think it was easier, as soon as some people didn't want cows around, to ban them to remote areas. And essentially cows were pushed out of the center part of the city as it became denser through laws that the city council was able to pass. But horses, laws affected their role and their place a great deal, but the real decision about whether horses would be in the city was an economic decision made by the generally wealthy people or the business owners who owned horses. So horses had a very gradual decline as individual people and individual city agencies made economic judgments about whether they belonged. But cows were essentially banned from roaming streets as soon as city elites decided they didn't belong in the city.
Say more about the considerations that led to most horses being eliminated from the city.
It was these economic choices by a variety of people, and laws to some extent shaped that. There were concerns about health, which pushed people to not want horses in the city. There were concerns about runaway horses. Horses are very different than automobiles, and they have a mind of their own. That works to their advantage in some ways, in that, for instance, on a dairy route, the horse could walk the route while the dairy man would deliver milk to houses and the horse would know which house to go to first. But horses also could run away and could become frightened by things in the city like bicycles or steam, and that created a great deal of dangers. So there are a variety of disadvantages to horses that were brought into these arguments as people debated whether they belonged, but ultimately the economic reality that automobiles could be more efficient was the main thing that pushed them out.
In what ways did social class affect the way Seattleites viewed animals?
Class was very important in that animals were important to the sustenance of people who were working class, but they often were not as important to middle class people. And, you know, chickens would be an example of that, that for a time in the city's history, chickens were woven into everybody's life. But at a certain point in the 1920s, it became possible not to have a chicken because of increased refrigeration and increased markets for meat and eggs. And so a class and indeed a racial divide emerged over the keeping of chickens. And middle class white neighborhoods began to ban chickens in the 1920s, whereas other parts of the city, the racially diverse neighborhoods and working class neighborhoods, continued to keep them. So for a time, chickens were a mean of sustenance in people's backyards for especially working class people and people of color, whereas white middle class neighborhoods define chickens as not appropriate in the modern city.
Say more about the ways in which animals help define some Seattle neighborhoods as white and middle class.
Well, those restrictive covenants that were established in neighborhoods in Seattle in the 1920s are infamous for their racial restrictions. They had codes in the deeds which made it illegal to sell that land to people that were not white, and that was made explicit. But there were also these livestock restrictions that were part of those deeds as well. And those livestock restrictions would sometimes list specific types of animals, but they would indeed refer to the type of relationship with animals, saying that pets were appropriate and livestock were not appropriate. So it's important to note that the racism of these covenants was explicit, but alongside that was an effort to make these neighborhoods middle-class neighborhoods and to keep out people of all sorts who might see the use of keeping animals for that productive relationship.
You are attuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Frederick L. Brown, author of the book, The City is More Than Human, An Animal History of Seattle. Would you speak about the shift from working animals to pets that has taken place during Seattle's history?
There's been a great shift from the presence of working animals to the presence of pets. And of course, I think it's important to keep in mind that as the animals that are visibly part of our lives are increasingly pets, there are in fact more and more distant animals that are livestock, which sustain the city. The irony of the evolution of life in the city over the last 100 years is that as livestock has become less and less present in our daily life and less visible, there are more and more livestock on distant factory farms that sustain our lives. So that's one aspect of that changing relationship. But pets have gone through an evolution through the 20th century in that in many ways, 100 years ago, pets mixed a kind of pet and livestock role. They mixed a sentimental and a utilitarian role, that dogs would be kept to protect property and cats would be kept to get mice, but they also were friends. And that has evolved much more to a pure pet-like relationship where they are kept almost exclusively for sentimental reasons.
What job opportunities have been provided by animals over time in Seattle?
Yeah, large parts of the economy were defined by animals in the past, and although it is somewhat hidden, we should keep in mind that large parts of the economy are defined by animals today, that the whole restaurant and grocery industry is filled with meat, milk, and eggs, and the whole health sciences and medical industry is based on animal testings. So there are all sorts of jobs that are dependent upon hidden animals, but in the past, horses were crucial to moving goods through the city, and cows and chickens were crucial to family economies, and it wasn't so much the kinds of jobs that census takers write down, and issues of gender are no doubt important in this, that census taker often put down a man's job but not women's work, and often women working in houses and keeping chickens were doing work that provided part of the family economy, and cows were perhaps equally tended by men and women, and even more so if the man was working far from the home. So cows and chickens were woven in to the work of every day, and horses were woven into the economy that becomes more visible in job titles.
What role have slaughterhouse industries played in Seattle's economy and food production for the city?
Slaughterhouses have undergone a huge transformation over the last 100 years or so, that in the 1890s, when Seattle was first developing its slaughterhouse district, in the area that's now south of the stadiums, south of downtown in Seattle, that was seen as a great sign of progress that Seattle was becoming a great city, that it was becoming the center of cattle and other creatures coming here on railroad cars from as far away as the Dakotas and being slaughtered here. And that was the sign of city's progress celebrated in newspapers. And there are neighborhoods certainly near South Seattle where many of the people that lived there worked in slaughterhouses, and that was woven into the daily life of the city. And then as we went through the course of the 20th century, that sort of work became moved to more and more distant places, often for reasons of economy and meat processing, owners wanting not to use the unionized workforce. And those industries have been moved farther and farther from the city so that this is an industry that is largely hidden from the lives of people today. Whereas in the early 20th century, you could stand on the top of Beacon Hill and see the stockyards in South Seattle.
In what ways did an interest in the humane treatment of animals develop in Seattle over time?
The Humane Society in Seattle had its first big importance in the gold rush. The gold rush, we often forget, when everyone was coming here to Seattle to go off to Alaska, involved all sorts of animals. It involved horses and dogs that were being sent to Alaska. And this huge influx of animals was noticed by the Humane Society, and they began efforts to help protect these animals. And humane efforts have played out throughout the history. And I think the biggest recent change in that was the 1960s and the 1970s, when the spay-neuter movement became more and more important. And that emerged in the context of a pet population boom after World War II and a rethinking of whether it was appropriate for public agencies to kill very large numbers of animals. And the spay-neuter movement was very effective in Seattle and in other places in greatly reducing the number of animals euthanized in animal shelters.
You've spoken a bit about this already, but how did restrictions on animals roaming free in Seattle change over time?
Certainly cows had a lot of freedom, and that was gradually restricted until 1907. Essentially, cows were banned from wandering in the streets. And then chickens were gradually banned. It started off with these restrictive covenants in neighborhoods in the 1920s, which was not city legislation, but private deeds. And chickens were finally banned completely in 1957 as part of an ordinance. And then back to the land movement in the 1970s and 1980s, Seattle TILF had chickens reauthorized in 1982. So there was a time period where there were certainly plenty of chickens despite the laws, but there was kind of a consensus in law that chickens did not belong in the city. But with the back to the land movement and growing interest in sustainability, a small number of people started keeping them legally again in the 1980s.
And how about dogs?
And dogs were the subject of an enormous debate from the 1930s to the 1950s about whether they should roam free. I've talked about the cow commons, and I also talk about the dog commons, that in Seattle before 1958, dogs could roam free if they had a license, and that was an assumption throughout the city's history. And starting in the 1930s, concerns about rabies started a debate about whether dogs should roam free. And that debate turned very quickly to issues of property. There are large numbers of petitions at the Seattle Municipal Archives which deal with the presence of dogs in cities. And I've gone through those to see what sort of topics are discussed. And issues of health are certainly important, concerns about feces, but the main issue is the protection of property, the protection of lawns and flowers and shrubs. So those issues of property led to the leash law in 1958. Of course, I think another thing that led to leash law was increasing dog populations. If you have a small number of dogs, you may tolerate them wandering the city. But as the economy grew and more people could afford dogs, there were more and more complaints. And eventually there was a citywide vote to establish a leash law.
We've been speaking about the history of Seattle mostly from the point of view of how animals have affected humans, but what has history been like from the perspective of animals?
I think it's important to think of the city from all those different perspectives, and really from the point of view of wild animals, the city is part of the ecology, and it is a place where they can thrive, and any number of creatures have thrived in this place that people have built here. I mean, that was true before newcomers came here, that the things that people did in burning land allowed some animals to thrive and others not to. And building a city has allowed crows to thrive and pigeons to thrive and house finches and all sorts of animals. So I think from the point of view of animals, you can think of the city as part of the habitat, which helps some animals and hurts other animals.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope this book will make people think about the important role of animals in our lives. And The point of the book is that animals have been crucial in the making and remaking of the city, and that the categories we use in thinking about animals bear thinking about. And I think of history as a conversation with the dead about what we value and how we want to live in this present moment. And different people will have different answers to that, but I hope that people can read the book and see these stories about how animals have fit into our lives in the city and put those stories in conversation with their lives as they make choices to have respect for animals and give animals the best possible lives.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message I'd like to leave them with is that animals have a crucial role in urban history, and that history has often been hidden, and that history should be recognized, and people should think about that important history as they try to live with animals every day.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Fred.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
You were just listening to Frederick L. Brown, author of the book, The City is More Than Human, An Animal History of Seattle, published in 2016 by the University of Washington Press. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.